Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Duane Freitas.
And I'm Tosin Unofawakin.
This week, tech giants take a stand against the FCC, Russia restricts free speech for bloggers, China's about to launch an IPO that may dwarf Facebook, who really won Samsung versus Apple, and more. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription links are in our show notes. And if you subscribe, leave us a review. Tell us how we're doing on iTunes. We want to hear from you. Join us at Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down, and write to us at comments@thedrilldown.com. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into the headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And over the last week was May 4th, or as the internet knows it, May the 4th be with you, the day that we celebrate all things Star Wars. And it was a Sunday. And I personally spent that Sunday with my sister-in-law's nephews, who are about that age. They're one, I think, is 5 and 1 is 3. And so they're kind of into Star Wars right now. And so we watched a couple of movies, or at least 1.5, I would say. We watched all of Star Wars 4. Or as I affectionately like to call it, just Star Wars.
Yeah.
and to emphasize that, I watched not the Blu-ray, but what's called Harmy's despecialized version, and that is a fan edit of Star Wars, where they've taken high quality sources, as many as possible, of the original 1977 release of Star Wars before George Lucas went in and made all those special edition adjustments, and they basically clean up the sources and create an HD master from that, and that's what I watched with the
kids.
Yeah,
we talked about this briefly.
It's the ultimate fandom. It's the ultimate love of fandom to kind of go out in there and say, we're going to use what's basically like a fair use in order to put together a movie around.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And that was the same videos that I showed the people who'd never seen Star Wars before.
Uh-huh.
At a box, we started off with the Harmy releases for all three of the older ones.
It'd be great if you put the link for these releases in the show notes.
I certainly will. And we followed it up with a screening of The Phantom Menace, which is Star Wars Episode I. And I have to say that I haven't seen The Phantom Menace in a while, and I had forgotten how narratively disjointed that movie was, and sort of hard.
You're
to
so
follow.
Polite.
I'm trying to be diplomatic about it, but obviously I'm not on a diplomatic mission. It's kind of a mess. I will say it's kind of a mess and all over the place. There are like highlights, like the Bunta Eve pod race is a big highlight of that movie. But outside of that, it kind of goes back and forth, and it's a little hard to follow. We didn't even really get through with the whole movie. It was just kind of a mess. And I don't remember that the other two prequels are better than this movie.
I would say that it's very clear that the third movie is fantastic compared to the first two movies of the second trilogy.
You're talking about
The Revenge of the Sith.
Revenge of the Sith.
Revenge of the Sith. It's got, it's one of those things where the the people putting it together
yeah.
realized that they had to hit a certain point of the history before they left this to the original trilogy. So they really had to like kind of get things done, and they did that. So it's a tighter film. And there's also like the tragedy aspect of the film,
yeah.
which if the other two films had been done, I think more to classic storytelling liking, you would have had a bit more build on that tragedy and it would have been a bit more emotional. But as it stands, the third one is a pretty...
What pretty I seem to remember movie. Of the third movie, which I once again, I haven't seen it in a while, but I do remember that it felt kind of like they were checking off a checklist. Like, you know, there's this gap of history between the prequel movies and Star Wars Episode IV, and there are all of these things that need to happen. And instead of having all of those key points in the timeline occur spaced out amongst the three movies, they kind of squished them all in the last movie, and they're like, okay, let's tick this box. Okay, that's done, that's done, that's done, that's done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a lot of retconning. There's no doubt. I mean, even the term the Clone Wars, like, it's we don't really refer to an endemic conflict as several wars, really. We usually refer to it as like some large conflict, like a World War II
yeah.
or World War I mm-hmm. Or the Great War. So like if it were the Great Clone War or something like that, that would make more sense given our language. But then you could go poetic license and all that stuff.
Sure.
And you kind of get there. You're right. There is definitely some checking off a list. But you do get some closure at the end of that film, which makes it a bit more exciting than the other ones. Highlights are a big piece of these first three films. And, you know, whether it's the Yoda battle, the fall of Qui-Gon Jinn,
yeah.
the opening Geonosis battle of the Clone Wars, the epic lightsaber battle between, you know, the four Jedi, Obi-Wan, Anakin, Yoda, and Count Dooku, or just sort of like the fall of Anakin in the third episode. There's a lot of highlights, but there's not a lot of super cohesive storytelling that kind of makes you say, "Wow, it's so tight."
Yeah,
and that's
yeah.
what the older trilogy does have. Which, you know, it's been almost it'll have been 10 years since the Revenge of the Sith came out in 2005.
Wow.
There's a good chance that, you know, the backlash, which is I think unless the people over at Star Wars are really out of touch, it's pretty legitimate backlash from everyone from, you know, purist geeks to legitimate film critics. You know, there are problems with these films. I'm pretty hopeful that they've learned, and that when Episode 7 does emerge, it will stand apart from those three and harken back to the sort of emotional relevancy of the
that
original.
Is the hope, at least.
Yeah, it in itself is a new hope.
Yeah, nice. How did you spend your 4th? May the 4th be with you.
I went down to a place called Rocky Flats. It's an old air base in Stapleton in Colorado. It also is the old home of like Colorado's big airport. And there was a mini Star Wars convention. There was an X-Wing. There were the local chapter of the 501st and the Rocky Mountain Star Wars fan club were there. A lot of people kind of dressed up. There is an artist there. He makes the guy who did very many of the Star Wars trading cards and worked on some of the comics, Kevin Graham. He was there and he had some, he taught a little lesson to the children. It was very children oriented. And he also had some prints of some of his work that I picked up, little 5x7s of some of the Galactic Empire's technology that I've always really liked. But yeah, I went down there with some friends and we did that. And then I, that morning before we left, I watched A New Hope. Episode 4, movie number 1, 1977. I feel like I'm Waze and I'm getting off the highway and I just have to say every single road that I'm about to be on. And then after that, you know, I went through, you know, the machete focus that Tosin is always talking about, this idea of watching episodes 4, 5, 2, 3, and then 6. The only difference is between 2 and 3, between Attack of the Clones and the Revenge of the Sith, I decided to insert the Clone Wars 3D animated series as well as Clone Wars, the 2003 2D micro series. So I'm actually making my way through that this week, sort of like, you know, I got some free time I'll watch some Star Wars. I'm just kind of Star Warsing it out. And I gotta say, the Clone Wars is interesting because I've seen many of it before.
Yeah.
When it first came out, I was interested. The idea of a show that was based on this stuff. It's not a perfect show, but it does really kind of scratch that itch of, you know, getting to know that expanded universe more. Some of the characters that are introduced in this show,
even though that expanded universe may be null and void in the coming from here on out.
It may be. I have a feeling that the amount of time, energy, and the use of the name Lucas on the credits, like George Lucas, not LucasArts, means that while we may not see characters from the expanded universe, they know that there's very good value in making sure the expanded universe fits as well as it can into the film universe. I do think that the expanded universe, insofar as what happens with on screen with the Clone Wars or Clone Wars, the micro series, is very close to canon, if not pretty canon. Now, anything you find in like, you know, video games or in comic books or regular books, obviously that's not going to be canon. But you know, the amount of production, time and energy spent on keeping this story alive and relevant with these animated works is pretty legitimate. So I have a feeling that we're not going to see a dissolution of them. Again, some of the characters, like the two female characters that are strong that you don't always get to see in Star Wars, you don't really see the super strong female characters. Obviously, Princess Leia was wonderful, but in the end, she ended up in the sexy outfit having to be saved. and so pretty much the same thing happened with her mother. But there are these two characters, Asajj Ventress and Ahsoka Tano, who show up in the comic books and stuff, but are really explored in these series, and they're kind of great to behold in terms of their scope and what they're capable of doing, and how the other people in the show have the characters that you do know have shaped their lives and made them who they are. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty good. I'm still going through it.
In terms of what you've seen so far for the Machete Order, any thoughts around that? Good, bad.
This isn't my first time seeing the it's my first time seeing the Machete Order without episode one. Every time I've tried it before, I've watched episode one as well, just because I was like, why leave it out? So this is my first time doing without episode one. And I'm going to say, with the exception of the characterization of Anakin, I don't really miss it. I Andy said, there's all these highlights. So with episode one, one of my favorite parts is when we get introduced to R2 and he goes out and he fixes that beautiful glass gleaming 1930s Amelia Earhart style spaceship that they're on. You know, there's something pretty about that. I like meeting C-3PO because the floor is not entirely stable. I like Anakin calling Natalie Portman an angel because, you know, I could see how someone his age thinks of someone who looks like she
does. If only that kid could act better. He's just a terrible actor. I'm sorry. It almost killed. Like I could forgive Lucas's stilted dialogue if it came out of a kid who could act.
So you basically wanted a little baby Harrison Ford? You'd be like, you an angel, baby? Like, why do you think I'm an angel? I love you. I know.
He shoots first, always.
Yeah. Yeah, so the versions I'm watching are not the purified ones. Han and Greedo shot at basically the same time. I did call out loudly in my house, no, Han shot first when that happened.
Excellent. Much to the
chagrin of both the animals that live with me. Luckily, my fiance wasn't here when that happened. But that's my story. I've been just kind of checking out. And it's, you know, the funny part is this quote unquote holiday is a piece of a shared culture. You know, I was standing there with I had a t-shirt on. It's a Calvin and Hobbes looking Han sitting in Chewie's like lap on a Millennium Falcon sled. So it's called like Han and Chewie instead of Calvin and Hobbes. And everyone had a comment about that. And I had a comment about everybody else's stuff because everyone was kind of in their Star Wars gear. And there were some really fantastic costumes. There was a car. It was in the parking lot. It was a FJ Cruiser that had been completely outfitted for Star Wars. The license plate said AT-AT, right? Like the little, you know, little images you have on the back of some people's vehicles that show like a mommy, a daddy, a couple kids, and a dog. It was Padme and Anakin with a little tiny Luke and Leia and the AT-AT as a dog. Like, it was like a car, but it was totally Star. The little like jack, the tow hitch was covered with the symbol of the Empire. It was very, you know, that's the level that these people were at this place. And it was, you know, that their actual vehicle is that's their jam. So anyway, it was a lot of fun.
I mean, one of the things that I think is pretty crazy about May 4th is that it is I can't really think of any if very many other movies that have been able to produce their own sort of holiday. Like right. The next closest thing I can think of is like the movie for Groundhog's Day, but Groundhog's Day is a thing.
Yeah,
right?
The holiday came first in that.
Right,
case.
Exactly. Can you think of any other movie that's had
the actual day event thing, that is that's definitely unique. The only other kind of piece of geek connection or kind of geek culture super hit on our mainstream culture that I've seen happen is like when Star Trek conventions used to happen regularly, right? So like they'd have a Star Trek convention every year and people would rush to just see Star Trek stuff. I think Star Wars has a bit more of an emotional and spiritual appeal than Star Trek has. So there's something to be said about the fact that it lingers on. Also, at this point, the amount of material is beginning to rival Star Trek's material in terms of its having risen back up to the top since its rebirth in 1997. Yeah. So yeah, there's definitely a lot there.
Yeah, I mean, Star Trek's got the head start on conventions, but Star Wars is making a sizable showing with Celebration.
And it doesn't need to have, like, there are fewer characters in Star Wars, that kind of thing. So it doesn't really need to have a convention even necessarily. Like, you can just be like, I'm having a Star Wars party at my house. It's rare to have a Star Trek party. Yeah. That was very organized. It was very Federation doing its thing. You know, Paramount putting on a convention. When it comes to Star Wars, people are kind of really on about their own. And when it comes to the actual materials, there's so many different facets of the characters you can be. Like, in Star Trek, people pretty much, if you're a Starfleet officer, you pretty much wear the same thing. You're Starfleet, Klingon, Bajoran, whatever. This, you know, there are people who were dressed as Jedi, as Sith, as Stormtroopers, you know, TIE fighter pilots, as, you know, X-wing pilots. Like they're all these little tiny costumes, and all this, you know, if you go to Etsy or, you know, Corellian Imports or any of these websites, they just create Star Wars paraphernalia to help push this stuff forward. So it's interesting.
Tosin, how about yourself? How did you spend the 4th?
So I did, interestingly, I also worked some more on R2 and updated my blog.
Nice.
So there are more actual posts on there about doing utility arm painting. And on the 5th, I got my R2-D2 dome, which is pretty amazing. So it's going to be things are picking up in that facet. But I, too, also watched the Clone Wars because it was, you know, I wanted to get my Star Wars fix. Didn't necessarily want to watch the films because I still haven't gone through all the Clone Wars. So I'm in season 2 and it's starting to get pretty interesting.
The plot thickens, right?
It definitely does. It's a nice, comfortable, you know, series that I can watch at home and, you know, sort of avoid some of the cares when it comes to some of the heavier series that I watch, you know, House of Cards, Game of Thrones, etc. This is a nice lighter series, but not always that light. Like, I just finished a couple episodes ago where something tragic happened, and I actually felt sad for, you know, a creature that, without giving too many spoilers away, but a creature that passed away.
Yeah, it's interesting, because not to jump on your thing, but one of the things about the Clone Wars is that it is made for like a 5 to 12-year-old audience when you're looking at it on Netflix, but characters die in ways that you don't normally see in animation. Like, there are times when they die by accident, there are times when they die cold-bloodedly, but there's no mistake that character is gone. That character is no longer going to show up because they have passed away because of sickness or violence. And that's something that's really interesting to me from a sort of children's show perspective.
Yeah, it's actually really interesting because probably almost every episode, someone from the good guy team has passed away.
There's a body count.
There are consequences. There are stakes.
Yeah, and then the clones, you know, at first, you know, it's clones. One of the reasons why clones and stormtroopers were there was so they can get shot and fall down like red shirts. But at the same time, you get to this point where you look at the clones as people because they introduce you to people, and the show does a pretty interesting job of making sure that clones are men, and these men have wants and needs and lives and all these things. So
you gain an emotional attachment to them. So it's like it's like, oh, did my buddy who I've known from, you know, the first five episodes just pass away, or was that someone else? And you know, heart-wrenching stuff. So ultimately, I think for all of us, it was a solid May 4th.
Yes.
So.
Yes. Those of you who want to surf geeksofdoom.com, our host site, there is a whole they do May the 4th day, Star Wars Day, up in style every year. And we'll have a link to their coverage in our show notes. Let's get into some of our hot topics. This week, in a rare public stand, Amazon has come out against the FCC. Their plan to bifurcate the internet into faster and slow lanes as part of the new network neutrality rules. We discussed these rules in the last couple episodes of the Drill Down, actually. Amazon joins a list of more than 100 tech firms, including Netflix, BitTorrent, Facebook, Google, Kickstarter, Twilio, Code Academy, OpenDNS, Zynga, Tumblr, Reddit, Foursquare.
The list goes on and on.
Yeah. 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 And basically they're protesting the plans to that will let ISPs charge content providers like Netflix or Amazon to deliver their packets faster or at a higher quality. The only thing about their letter that I felt was a little sort of hedging their bets, not pleading strong enough, is and this is according to the article here in GigaOM, the letter comes out against paid prioritization but offers FCC chairman Wheeler an out by blaming the media for possibly misunderstanding how he really intends to play this rulemaking process.
This caused the tech and media world to freak out about the death of the open internet. While the FCC has tried hard to downplay this threat, it's also been, mm-hmm. you know, unable to convince people knowledgeable about the industry that this plan isn't a step back from the open internet. So, I mean, we talked about this a little earlier before the show, but it's clear that these guys want the FCC as an ally, and they want to show their support for the FCC, which mm-hmm. has already tried to move the net in a neutral space, but has had to contend with federal courts passing out rulings and saying you don't have this mandate. This is not your jurisdiction. You don't have the power to say that AT&T and Comcast and these guys can't charge. So while the FCC is figuring out what they need to do, and Netflix is taking its own position and so on, that's causing people like us to freak out. What's interesting is how these guys are saying, look, we believe in this open internet, and we are behind you. We're so behind you. Let me list every single company behind you. And if you just look at those companies, and you look at the percentage of GDP that those companies hold, the raw revenue, the raw profit, the market cap, all the pieces of what these companies are that you're seeing, there's something significant here. They are saying, in many respects, we've got resources and we've got your back. And I think that the FCC is probably sitting in their offices right now. The chairman is sitting in his or her office right now, trying to figure out the next step, knowing that they've got this kind of weight behind them. On the other hand, AT&T and Comcast are no small potatoes. But when you look at what's fueling the usage of AT&T and Comcast, you know, these guys' pipes, it's these, like, you know, many, 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 many companies, top companies. And so I think that the courts are going to have to take a look and see, you know, because they haven't heard from these companies on this issue. They've heard from Comcast. They've heard from AT&T. They've heard from these guys who are saying, hey, we're a big deal. We built this stuff. We want to get paid for it. But they haven't heard from the other side of the equation. And the court, when it makes its decision, especially the Supreme Court, it makes it based on what the best thing is for society at the time. But I don't think the argument has been laid out by those people who are influencing society in this focused, monetized way to any courts. Like we've said before, there hasn't been any lobbying. There hasn't been any lawsuits. There hasn't been any of that. It's kind of been like, you know, the guys on the tech side have been like, well, the system should work and, you know, we're doing the right thing and that's how it should be. But I think as they realize that the system doesn't always work when it comes to preserving an open internet or the thoughts behind an open internet, they're going to have to become more eloquent as to their arguments as to why it should succeed. And luckily for everybody who's involved, they've got the resources to do it. It's just a question of how they plan to approach it. And this is an interesting way to start that.
Yeah, I mean,
you're not the enemy. We're not the enemy FCC.
It's pretty awesome that you know, a major contingent is going after this and taking a stance. And the nice thing about it is I think we talked about it maybe last week, mm-hmm. how some things were being explained to like the Supreme Court for other aspects, and sort of not giving the full truth to the picture and not explaining it both from, you know, how what this means to technology and how people interact, really more of a one-sided sort of,
at least not doing it eloquently, not explaining the social cost, the monetary cost,
you know, a coalition like this can do that. I think, you know, that's one of the at least benefits, is that we can make sure that, you know, they can at least make sure their voice is heard, but they can at least also present the other side of the picture, which I think very often it's a one-sided argument where, you know, they're just hearing it from the big businessmen, but not also hearing it from, you know, the other people, right?
Yeah, I mean, another thing here is that, you know, as you look at this letter, the only thing that could make it more powerful is if it had, like, the signatures of each of the CEOs of these companies,
right?
You know, at the bottom, like, you know, right. A Declaration of Independence or some other thing, like, you know, like John Hancock's just sitting there. It's pretty powerful because it sits there and it says, we want you to understand that there are problems to this approach, and you know, it's an opening salvo. Perhaps a sleeping giant has been awoken in this fight.
Well, the giant will really have woken up when it starts using lobbying powers to counter the lobbying that the ISPs are doing.
If it does. I mean, it's one thing for them to say we agree to these principles, another thing to say, okay, who's going to spend what money in order to get us from here to there?
Well, I think you got to put your money where your mouth is, right?
Right. It's just the proportions, right? Yeah. Like, they have to have some sort of governing body that has to, you know, they have to come to agreement. And it's very difficult to come to agreement with lots of people about who's spending what, you know, because then, you know, some of these guys are competitors with one another. Some of these guys have a certain relationship with someone else, but they'd rather have a relationship with another person. Some of these guys are, you know, trying to share their top line secrets of profitability or whatever. Or they don't want to expose how much they really need this to their business strategically. To their competitors. So, you know, it's going to be difficult to say, well, you know, Amazon, let's put you down for this amount of million of dollars. And Google, let's put you down for that amount of million of dollars. That's not going to be necessarily an easy conversation for them to have.
Yeah. Okay, moving on here. Russia. Okay, so we're going across the world now to Russia. Russia has taken another major step towards restricting its once freewheeling internet, as President Putin quietly signed a new law requiring popular online voices to register with the government, a measure that lawyers, internet pioneers, and political activists said would give the government a much wider ability to track who said what online. Widely known in Russia as the Blogger's Law, it specifies that any site with more than 3,000 visitors daily will be considered a media outlet akin to a newspaper and be responsible for the accuracy of the information published. Besides registering, bloggers can no longer remain anonymous online, and organizations that provide platforms for their work, such as search engines, social networks, and other forums, have to keep computer records on Russian soil of everything posted over the previous 6 months.
The Great Wall of Russia is getting built.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. It's not really the Great Wall of Russia. It's like the great warning shot of this 140 million people country. Mm-hmm. I mean, President Putin, the first two letters of his name are PU because this stinks. he's sitting there and he's saying, basically, freedom of speech is a problem. I'm not going to go out and say freedom of speech is a problem, but I am going to say that if you ever say anything against me or my people, you better be able to back it up. And if you back it up, you have to be able by law to back it up, or else I'm going to call you libelous and throw you in jail. Now, if you do back it up, here's where I win as well. I can find out your source, and I can take that source, and I can throw it in jail. Either way, you say something against me, you better be able to prove it in a way that I cannot throw anybody in jail, or else the jig is up for you. That's really the gist of this situation, right?
Yeah, I feel like this is going to backfire on him to a certain extent. Like, I feel like
yes
it's going to,
no.
You know, as one great princess once said, the more you tighten your grip, the more star systems will slip through your fingers.
Okay. Yeah, you know. I mean, if Putin is Grand Admiral Tarkin, then literally this will blow up in his face. But I think the difference here is that he's basically said, look, about 2 weeks ago, he said, hey, man, we're Russia. We don't have the capability of the U.S. to track everything that everybody is saying. And then he passes this law that basically says, you must keep data on everybody and what they're saying here on Russian soil so that I can now track everybody and what they're saying and thus call them into court or like arrest them or whatever if they get in my way. So like that's one of the things where it's just one of those clever, very clever ways of manipulating the situation so that you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And he does that by making sure that if you want to operate in Russia, you're going to have to keep you can't destroy files. You can't have real secrecy. You can't have any kind of anonymity. You can't have any document retention program like many of the companies here in the U.S. where you're saying, look, I got some information, but, you know, I'm not going to keep it forever. I'm not going to keep this phone record forever. I'm going to get rid of it. And Putin's like, no, you can't do that. Places like Secret may have to keep records in Russia. If there's a secret that if they get more than 3,000 hits a day, right? and 3,000 hits, I mean, in America, that's really nothing. I don't know what Russia's internet situation is like. I know Russia is considered a developing country. They're not quite where we are when it comes to this. But there are a country that uses online tools in order to disseminate information and is, you know, in many ways, the online media has been aligned with the West. And Putin wants to shut that down. And this is one of the ways he's going to do it. The bottom line is he's like, hey, look, I want all the data about everybody writing stuff that's influential here in Russia so my people can take a look at it and I can data mine it and do with what I need to do. Maybe he'll take some of that data and he'll use it to strengthen his opinions on things or like try to find public sentiment or maybe – but I doubt it. I think he's going to use it to shut down open speech, which is sad. It's like this is the end of open speech era of the internet between net neutrality and this kind of law.
Didn't the Soviet Union disband to prevent this exact sort of thing happening?
I'm not really. I don't know all the details about the disbandment of the Soviet Union.
I feel like we're slowly inching into just becoming the Soviet Union again, but under the name of the Russian Republic,
Russian Federation. Yeah. I mean, Putin has long said that the breakup of the Soviet Union was one of the biggest political catastrophes of the 20th century. I don't know if it's because he didn't believe in communism. The thing about, you know, what the Soviets were about and what the current Russia is about is that the Soviets were about, hey, look, you can't just kind of be out for yourself. We got to like make everybody have access to stuff, at least in theory. In the current situation in Russia, it's a pretty capitalist situation run by oligarchs. So I'm pretty sure he doesn't want to be Soviet Russia, but he definitely wants that sphere of influence, that level of political power and the ability to project it around the world. In order to do that, a lot of what he seems to be doing is keeping control of what he's got at home in terms of like public support and looking like a strong leader and propaganda and so on. And so he's got to manage the message. And the way he's going to manage the message is, you know, by basically calling people out if they have something to say against him or anyone that he supports. At the same token, he pulled all of his troops away from the Ukrainian border today. So that's something to think about, too. It's unclear what is going on in Putin's mind, but this law is one that would not fly. This law would be worse than PIPA or CISPA in the U.S.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, moving on here. John Carmack, the man who co-created Doom, who co-founded id Software, and who later left id for Oculus VR, is being accused by his former employer, ZeniMax Media, of taking intellectual property with him to Oculus VR. ZeniMax sent claims to Oculus stating it was only through the concerted efforts of Mr. Carmack using technology developed over many years and owned by ZeniMax that the Oculus founder was able to transform his garage-based pipe dream into a working reality. John Carmack took to Twitter to respond, quote, "No work I've ever done has been patented. ZeniMax owns the code that I wrote, but they don't own VR." Oculus denies the claims, as would be expected. They say, we're disappointed but not surprised by ZeniMax's action and will prove all of its claims are false. They then laid out a list of refutations to ZeniMax claims, including, quote, there is not a line of ZeniMax code in any of its technology or any Oculus products, and ZeniMax did not pursue claims against Oculus for IP or technology. Oculus's statements out some interesting details about the history of ZeniMax working with the Oculus VR Palmer Luckey. For example, Oculus claims that, quote, a key reason that John permanently left ZeniMax was that ZeniMax prevented John from working on VR and stopped investing in VR games across the company. So now that Oculus has been snatched up by Facebook, suddenly they want back in.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of unfortunate that now is the time they bring this up.
Or fortunate. I mean, let's look at this. When Google bought YouTube, the first company to make a move was Viacom, suing Google because of YouTube stuff, right? Viacom didn't have an online video solution, but YouTube had been taking the Jon Stewart stuff, the Stephen Colbert stuff, and throwing it online. And, you know, they've got ads, and they were making money off of the ads, but it was other people's content. Why did they wait until Google bought them to sue them?
Yeah.
Because they didn't really have any money then. They could go and sue them and stop it, but they couldn't get anything out of it. When it comes to Oculus Rift and Facebook, Facebook's purchase of Oculus Rift suddenly puts, you know, ID Software, its parent, in a position to get money out of anything John Carmack has to give to these companies, because Facebook has money. They just spent $19 trillion on WhatsApp.
Yeah.
So $19 billion, sorry, on WhatsApp. So, you know, from a legal perspective, it's the smart financial and legal decision to make. Let's wait till this all settles and clears, and then we can say, boom, we're going to go after you. Now, the problem for John Carmack is that it's pretty clear that any and everything he did for the last 20 years was at ID Software, and he basically is walking intellectual property. It's almost impossible to extract the work he wants to do at Oculus from the work he did at ID Software. And while I'm pretty sure non-competing stuff is not really enforceable, especially in the states that he's working in, it's the kind of stuff where he's got all this data, and it's going to be very difficult to pick out what belongs to ID Software and what belongs to him, because he gave himself to ID Software for so long. He built that company.
Mm-hmm.
So it's messy. It's very messy. And I think it's going to have to go to trial, or they're going to come to some settlement, because I think, you know, ID Software and its parent just kind of wants to be paid for the loss of John Carmack, who was at the heart of their talent and their product. They're really just going to have to either get paid out by Facebook, or they're going to take this to trial and try to drag it to the ground.
Yeah, well, I guess we'll have to see how it goes through the laws, but this could be a very long fight, given that, you know,
I don't even know if they have the money to keep the fight up. These the ID Software.
Yeah,
I don't know.
For me, Facebook doesn't seem like a company that would just give in on something like this.
Oh, yeah. Facebook isn't going anywhere. I do think, though, that in order to make this go away, there's always a price. If you know it's going to cost $14, $15 million to adjudicate this thing through arbitration and lawsuits, or you know they'd go away for $5 million, you're going to pay them $5 million. With the exception of the Apple Samsung suits that we're seeing, a lot of, you know, I think 97% of cases brought up with complaints and settling out of court. The Apple Samsung stuff is almost like a religious holy war, so you're not going to see that. And the numbers are very big, 120 million and so on and so forth. We'll talk about that later. But when it comes to stuff like this, Facebook has a choice to make. Do they want to spend the time and resources to go through this, or can they just pay these guys off? Or if they're really angry, can they make it so that they countersue and make it so expensive that these guys are like, oy vey. And this is the kind of thing that we see a lot when it comes to companies wanting to get money out of other companies. It's a question of like, can I get through the fight? Can I afford to fight it? Yada, yada, yada.
Right. Okay. And moving on here, Amazon rolled out an interesting new feature called hashtag Amazon Cart this week, which lets you add Amazon products to your shopping basket without leaving Twitter. First, you have to connect your Twitter and Amazon accounts which you do through your social settings, and then all you have to do is reply with hashtag Amazon cart to any tweet that contains an Amazon product link, and it will be added to your own Amazon shopping basket. It won't actually purchase the product directly. It just saves it to your account to order later, after which you'll receive an email and reply from Amazon outlining the status of that request, or if it's out of stock. That's a pretty clever idea, I think.
I think that's a pretty clever and simple idea, right? They already have the ability for you to tweet out that you've purchased something, and maybe if you find something really cool or an awesome sale on Amazon, you can just, you know, send it out, and then your Twitter followers can reply. Or if you think of it on, you know, the social sites that see various deals, they can just be like, hey, retweet our tweet, giving them A, publicity on Twitter, right? Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. B, allowing people a very easy way to purchase. So,
and it's an affiliate link, so you get credit.
No, oh, exactly.
That's the big thing. Amazon's very good on the affiliate side for this kind of thing. So you get credit out of that. So
a very, very smart move. Very smart move, and probably didn't take, well, hard to say, but I don't think it probably took too much work to get it to work. Properly.
Right, and it's just another way for Twitter to make revenue. I mean, like, we talked about how Twitter bought GNIP the other day, being able to take that data, mine it successfully, and get real insights out of it that the advertisers can use. This is a way of affiliate tracking from Amazon with, you know, through Twitter, which gives Twitter another way of saying, hey, Amazon, we're responsible for some of the We can show our value with being responsible for some of the purchases that are made in your site. Tosin bought something. Dwayne sees it. Dwayne's like, I'm down. I want that. Or you know, it's on Tosin's wish list. Did I see it? And I'm like, I'm down. I want that. And you can give me a piece of the pie based on the fact that I'm using my massive social media engine to drive sales for you. You're getting incremental revenue. I'm getting incremental revenue. This user's getting their product. Everybody's happy, and hopefully we'll get more into incremental revenue as these kind of purchases go viral.
It's a great addition to Amazon's social sharing aspect, I think.
Yeah, and there's a lot of room for Amazon to grow here. We talked before the show about how there's it'd be wonderful, for instance, if I'm sending something from Amazon that I'm buying to Andy, who's another Amazon user, if I could share the actual push notifications with him about the item in transit, you know, like I don't have to be the only one getting those notifications. It's left the facility. It's whatever. Another thing is, hey, I'm looking at something. Hey, did you know Amazon can tell me, did you know that 9 of your friends or 10 of your friends were looking at this thing too? And then I could say, oh, really? Will you let them know that I'm interested? I'd love to talk to them. And then Andy or Tosin can get an email saying, Dwayne would love to know what you think about the egg minder that you bought the other day. Like, do you love being able to check your eggs and how many you have? And they'd be like, no, dude, don't get that. But you can really get into it with Amazon. The amount of data they have, the amount of users they have, and the fact that so many – Amazon's Prime membership is almost viral. It's people explaining to other people how you got to do it because it's just such a good deal. And then let's not even begin to think about what happens when people start sharing what they're watching on Amazon Prime with one another, letting people know, hey, you really got to try this show out, hey, whatever, something that Netflix used to do but doesn't do so well anymore. So there's a lot for Amazon to expand in this space.
And moving on, okay, so Dwayne, you brought up the story about changes in patent laws.
Right, so like, you know, we've been talking about Amazon and how they're like, hey man, we want, the, you know, and all the rest of those guys and how they want to like, you know, they offered like a glimmer of hope for this whole FCC situation, net neutrality. And then Putin and how, you know, he's kind of like a shadow of the empire with his Soviet kind of outlook on what's going on the internet. One other new glimmer of light is this idea that patent trolls, the guys who are basically law firms.
A blight on society.
Yeah.
A
blight on innovation. Basically, these patent troll organizations, they are the equivalent of, like, you know, companies, but they're really just a whole bunch of lawyers that are tied to or represent a big portfolio of patents. And what they do is they search the technology space for any product that could possibly be infringing on their patent, and they go after them. And oftentimes, you know, they'll say, hey, we think you're infringing on my patent, new startup. And the new startup is like, mm-hmm. really? Am I infringing on your patent? Like, yeah, we think it's going to cost you $1 million. We're going to sue you for $1 million. But if you want to settle, just give us $10,000. And those guys are like, how much is it going to cost to actually go against these guys in court? I guess we're going to settle because we can, you know, maybe get away with $10,000, et cetera. So what ends up happening is that they do this because they have the power. They have the financial power to say it's going to cost you so much to adjudicate this issue in court that it's not going to be viable for you. Or you don't have the legal expertise to really get around this.
Yeah.
So people just kind of like settle. There's a new case that just got decided, Octane Fitness versus Icon. And basically the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, that this is a special court in D.C. that deals with patents. And they basically said they added what we call a loser pays provision in these patent infringement cases. So whereas Icon was saying, hey, look, you guys owe us all this money because you stole a patent. You know, Octane Fitness was like, we stole no patent from you. And they're like, okay, well, I'll see you in court. So Octane Fitness was like, you know what? We're going to make it so that we win this. We're going to put everything in it. We're going to make it happen. And what ended up happening was the Supreme Court upheld the Federal Circuit Court of the Patent Court's decision that, in fact, there were no patents being stolen here. And basically, the Icon company, the patent troll, was seeking to enforce a patent on equipment that it kind of just kept on the shelf for the express purpose of suing companies if those companies ever showed up with something similar to this. So they were having patents, they were holding them on the shelf. If anyone ever shows up with something similar, we'll sue them, we'll make money off of it. That's how we're going to make money off the product. And the court said, no, that's not a way to make money. That's not what the patent law was designed for. It's incorrect. You're a patent troll, and that's not okay. Moreover, we're going to make it so that these guys were intimidated about actually going up to you and fighting you on this because it's so expensive to fight these court battles. You're the loser. You're going to pay their court fees. And forevermore, this decision now lays out that if you're a patent troll and you lose the case,
yeah,
you may very well have to pay the court fees of the person that you said infringed upon you. Now, obviously, in this case, they had the overwhelming negativity of having held a patent on a shelf for the purpose of suing for it. I don't know if that's going to be the case for everything, but it does show that there is a glimmer of hope in this technology space where people are afraid of patent litigation based on ideas that may have arisen independently simply because, you know, these other people have more money or they have more clout or they have more money or they have better representation or whatever. The court basically says, A, the premise of patent trolling, the whackness of just saying I'm going to keep something on a shelf and if you go out and if you try to make anything close to it, I'm going to sue you, that's wrong. And two, if we find that you're wrong, you're going to have to pay the court fees. So the court fees that are basically like built into your cost of operating,
yeah,
are going to come out of that. So as a patent troll organization, your profitability is going to diminish. So it's just a huge win in the patent space.
Yeah, yeah. Make patent trolls think twice.
Exactly. This isn't going to get in the way of the Apple-Samsung kind of situation where Apple's like, you stole my tech and then you made these phones and you stole business from me. It is going to get in the way of this sort of, I'm a small company, I've got an idea, oh wait, I didn't realize that like of the 7, 8 million patents in the world, 10 million patents in the U.S., I didn't realize that this person had something that was similar to mine.
And everybody has something similar to some small company's patent.
Exactly. Or like it's different from mine, but it's similar enough so that they can convince me that I am stealing from them. And so I'm going to just do what I can to make them go away, even if it bankrupts me. Thus, innovation isn't going to get out in the space because the idea of holding innovation on the shelf so that you could sue other people when they come up with it is counter to the whole patent system. Chris Warren over here, I think he'd be pleased because this is kind of a redeeming factor in the patent system that so many people in Silicon Valley just want to get rid of. I really think this is kind of one of those things where it shows that if it's protected properly, it can work.
Yes, I agree. This sounds like a good move, positive move. I'd love to see the first few cases that are the fallout from this decision. All right, let's talk a little bit about our sponsor. Our sponsor is Audible.com, and for the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And because we are talking about a post-May the 4th holiday, we of course have to bring up a Star Wars audiobook. The one that we're going to talk about is Star Wars Labyrinth of Evil, which you, Dwayne, have personally listened to.
I have. It was actually one of the first books I ever listened to straight away. Yeah. A friend gave it to me as a gift back in 05, right before I saw Star Wars Episode III at the Revenge of the Sith. And basically, it details the last couple of weeks or months before the beginning of the third Star Wars episode. And it goes into sort of the dealings with Count Dooku and the Trade Federation and Anakin and all these guys. And this kind of, you know, that culminates in, you know, the kidnapping of Senator Palpatine. Mm-hmm. And it's a fast listen. I actually got the book later and I read it because that's how I am. It's a fast read, but it's one of those books that's, you know, while the one narrator is reading the whole thing and he's got different voices for each character, there are sound effects in it, which were pretty compelling. Laser bolts, from blasters or, starships, the sounds of, you know, the lightsabers, parts of the themes from different characters as they entered or left the scene that you're listening to in the book. It was pretty great, and it did a lot of tying together of the relationship between Obi-Wan Kenobi and Anakin Skywalker, because it was not so clear in the very beginning of Episode III that they were less in a master-student relationship and more of a close friend brother relationship. So it was pretty great piece of expanded universe. Definitely, you know, I'd only read Shadows of the Empire and the Thrawn trilogy before that, so that was my only tie into the expanded universe. And this kind of really kind of broke it wide open for me. So it was like part of that whole Star Wars Renaissance, and definitely a good listen. Quick, James Luceno is a fast writer. He's got a lot to say. He's very good at science fiction. There's a ton of his books that are out there, many of them on Audible. So
Audible's got a ton of Star Wars-related titles, tons of the expanded universe stories. Even though, as we've discussed now, the expanded universe, you can still enjoy the expanded universe, but it may not be canon anymore at this point.
Right, right.
So to download that free audiobook or any one of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. And using that URL helps The Drill Down out on the show here, so please do that. Even if you don't like Audible, you can cancel it and you still get to keep the book for free. All right, we're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, China steps into the global IPO ring and refuses to be ignored. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Boom!
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafowakin. Chinese e-commerce colossus Alibaba on Tuesday filed for an initial public offering that is poised to be one of the largest in history and will create a mighty rival to Silicon Valley's tech giants. With its entry into the U.S. stock market, Alibaba, which is often described as a combination of eBay, Amazon, and Google, will have a valuation estimated at $150 billion to upwards of $200 billion, giving it an immediate market value greater than Facebook and Amazon. A successful IPO will give the company the resources to fend off rivals in China, make big bets on future technology trends, expand its global reach, and build momentum for more Chinese companies to make public offerings in the U.S. The Alibaba stock debut is a defining moment for Yahoo, also, which owns about 23% of the company and is expected to sell nearly half of its stake in the IPO, which could remove a major underpinning of Yahoo's own stock value, which has soared 45% over the past year, even as its advertising business has continued to lose ground to rivals such as Google and Facebook. Analysts say investors have bid up Yahoo shares largely because of excitement over the Alibaba IPO. Alibaba's investment represents more than two-thirds of Yahoo's total stock market valuation. That's concerning because once that goes away, Yahoo will have to basically prove itself on its own by its own merits.
As we all know, Alibaba definitely has that power to be a big disruptor in the market, and more so is going to, or at least I believe, is going to highly evaluate a lot of the other stocks out there. I think the market is going to see quite a increase, and more people will be participating.
We'll get this huge ripple effect from the...
Yeah, exactly. You've seen cases where you have a negative effect. Well, yeah, you can also have positive effects when there are large IPOs of that nature. So good for the U.S. market, good for competition if it does stem that.
Definitely good for China.
Hopefully, potentially good for consumers.
I'm not too familiar with everything Alibaba does. I know it gets this kind of like Facebook, Amazon, Google kind of tie-in description. But given the massive flop that the Facebook IPO was when it first started out, it just kind of dropped. From an outside investor perspective, people who worked at Facebook got paid. I just kind of don't know what to think about this massive valuation. I hope that the people who built the company get paid. I guess after the Facebook thing, I learned that I don't really care if Wall Street doesn't get paid.
What do you think will be the effect that it will have on Yahoo stock once Yahoo sells its half interest in it?
I don't know. I think on some level, Yahoo, people might say, well, Yahoo, you're missing out on the growth here. But I think Yahoo is in many ways anticipating that the price will go down shortly after the valuation will go down shortly after the thing IPOs. So they want to get the most out of it. There's also the fact that, as a public company, do they want to keep a lot of their value in another public company? That's a question that some investors may very well think is not the greatest idea, which is why they're taking that step. So I kind of don't know. I think Yahoo stock will probably go up a little bit as they have more money in the bank. They sell this, they pay off any debt they have, and hopefully there's something left over, some capital for them to invest in themselves and what they want to do.
I have a feeling we're going to be revisiting this issue from Yahoo's POV once the IPO happens, and the stock, the ripple effect affects Yahoo stock. Okay, moving on here. Foursquare announced this week that it'll split the Foursquare app into two apps. The newly rebranded Foursquare app will lose its check-in features and instead will compete with review site Yelp, focusing solely on local recommendations. And the second app, a new one called Swarm, will gain Foursquare's check-in capability and show users which of their friends are nearby. This split stemmed from conversations with users, during which Foursquare found that most rely on the app for two reasons: to discover new places and to meet up with friends. Foursquare's changes also seem to capitalize on a mobile app trend, taking online friendships offline to meet up in person. Swarm will be available on iOS and Android within the coming weeks, and the rebranded Foursquare will come later on this summer. In related news, a new version of Google's Drive app, recently released for iOS and coming soon to Android, Google is removing the ability to edit documents from it. The change comes alongside the new standalone Docs and Sheets apps, which is now linked to the Drive app. So basically, when you go to edit a document in Drive, it prompts you now to download one of the standalone apps if you haven't already, which may seem inconvenient, but it's apparently part of Google's move to unbundle its Drive app into clearer apps with specific uses.
I mean, I already have a Google folder.
Yeah.
For in like a Google productivity folder, of all the various Google products that I'm making use of. To back to the whole Foursquare and Swarm thing.
Yeah.
I do see where they think that they're making a good move. Foursquare is obviously trying to pivot and make sure that it can show revenue and show usage and these things. But at the same time, you know, with Facebook moving its Messenger app to something different and telling me to get that second app, I find that I don't want to do that. With Foursquare, I guess I could see many people just kind of like me, I might just use the Swarm thing and not use the recommendation thing. I just don't know. Like when I check into something and I enter in a tip, do I then get prompted to the Swarm app? These aren't smooth transitions on an iPhone, and I, you know, the whole card switching thing and all that.
Yeah.
I don't know that it's going to, I mean, I'll have to see the implementation, but I don't know that I'll feel like I'm going to have a better time. I also know that over the last several months, I've been removing apps. I want 2 pages of apps.
Yeah.
I don't want more. And the idea that I'm getting more is problematic. Now with Google, purpose-built applications for purpose-built applications, you know, productivity applications, it's an easier sell, especially because if you think about the product teams.
Yeah,
now, you know, I'm working on documents, and I'm somebody else, and someone else is working on the spreadsheet piece of it. They've got to sync their submissions to the App Store, and they have to make sure things don't break. And that's a lot of work for a company to figure out, right? To say, I've got this new implementation in the document side, and I've got this new implementation in the spreadsheet side, and I've got another implementation that I want to throw in for the presentation side, and they've all got to go to the same app account on the same iTunes situation, and all those things have to go into the same app, and then Apple has to sit there and evaluate to make sure the whole thing works and isn't doing anything like they don't want it to do. That's a lot for one app. It is. So the idea that they've broken it up makes a lot of sense. They can push their changes when those changes are necessary instead of waiting.
Yeah, I mean that makes sense, but from a user perspective, I guess what mm-hmm. especially what you're saying about having multiple apps, having multiple having multiple data stores, it's kind of,
well, Google, it's still one data store. That's what's interesting. And also right, you're used to opening up, you know, Word or whatever on your desktop machine.
Yeah, but I mean, by that I mean on the iOS device, each application is secluded from one another, right? So there is isolation in terms of how it's being on the device. And if I wanted to clear, you know, cache or memory for a certain app, I could. But I definitely, I guess my curiosity is how this.
But then you can't do that on the app. If there's a big Google app, Google Drive app, and you're using the spreadsheet and it's informing a document that you're writing, you've got to move back and forth within that app, and that app is using a ton of memory. If you can move back and forth between two separate apps and you can decide that you could jump with the spreadsheet so you can close it and finish writing what you have to write, then you're actually freeing up memory.
I guess I'm curious how devices are going to react to a larger and larger plethora of applications. Because sure, you can put them in folder, in, you know, containers, but still it becomes very unwieldy to manage all of them.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to be the easiest transition for a lot of things, but I think when it comes to what Google's trying to do and the type of – I mean, I don't know if you played with the Google Drive spreadsheet app on your device, but it's a magnificent marvel of software engineering. It's not something that's easily – tweaked, and especially if it's got to worry about breaking something else, another bit of functionality. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I feel like the juice is worth the squeeze on that one. I just don't know, and I'm not a big Yelp user, so I don't know if the Foursquare one is going to be the same, if it's going to be such a jump up in functionality. I know for certain that I stopped using Facebook messaging when there was a new app, because it just was like, well, I'll just text them. If I got to go to a different app, I'll just text them, you know?
Like, I have to admit that I'm not crazy about this trend of unbundling apps and creating individual apps. There's an article in Pando Daily that proposes that bloated applications, all in one applications, would have app burnout, would cause people to have app burnout. But claims of app burnout are most people aren't sick of downloading new apps, and they come to love downloading new apps even more. But I kind of refute that, and I like one app.
You'd like one app for one service.
One app for one service. Like the whole when Facebook started to come out with Paper and Chat and all of these other, you know, separate apps to handle the different aspects of Facebook, I was kind of annoyed, because I'm like, I was already doing all of that in the Facebook app.
Yeah. So here's the thing. When you look at the Facebook app, I remember I've had trouble with my iPhone. Like I move iPhones every year, and you know, I'll move the image over from iCloud onto a new device, and you know, I'll have issues. I'll go into the Apple Store, and as much as I hate doing that, and they'll say, okay, you got some programs crashing here. I'll be like, okay, what do you have? A lot of it is the Apple programs, but one of the most consistent ones was Facebook. Why? Because it was doing so many things at once and eating up so much memory at once that it was consistently unstable. And when they broke it up and they began to focus its various services, the app became more stable. It's a lighter app that the phone deals with much better, and it's more stable. This is necessary when you're dealing with – if you're looking at a growth opportunity for you as Google in terms of getting people on your app suite, you need that to be as stable as possible. If your app suite's app is crashing because it's running – presentation, spreadsheet, and documents all at once, as someone's trying to move back and forth between things, and it goes down and information is lost, you're in a much worse position than if people just had to flip from one to the other. Yeah. And I mean, as a developer challenge, it's very easy to see why Google is doing this. When it comes to what Foursquare is doing, it definitely is more of a perception and marketing challenge, although I imagine that the two teams involved on the recommendation side and the check-in side are also two different teams that don't necessarily want to cross swords when they're trying to get the app updated. Because you have to think about it. There's got to be a coordination team that just sits there, and they are literally running the changes submitted by each separate service team onto the app as submitted to the Apple Store and dealing with that without actually being the ones who are developing that app. That leads to inefficiency as well. So based on the way apps are designed and submitted and distributed, this does make sense on the current architecture.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand it in the case of Google, where there's so many services under the one brand that you do need separate apps for the different facets of what Google is. But I don't think I have that same sort of compartmentalization, at least mentally, when I think of Facebook.
Yeah. Right, so Facebook is an all-encompassing communication service, so it is a little weird that you have to break it out to this app. But then when you think about the fact that they started adding voice chat and all these other things, their app is incredibly – it was bloated. It was bloated unlike any other. I think it was on the top 10 of the app of the iOS store for, you know, 4 out of the 5 years it was around, top 10 or top 15. And – you know, they just kept on throwing stuff into it, and you know, they try everything. Redesigns happen to that app all the time, but the fact is, they needed to smoothen it out. Now, you're right. You're absolutely right. For me as well as for you, the differentiation between apps makes me, you know, I don't use the other apps. I just don't use them. Yeah. I use Facebook as basically a read only and commentary device. I don't use it for the messaging anymore because of that. So yeah, I think that they've got an issue. Now, this is why a Google phone makes sense. This is why a Facebook phone makes sense. They can get all these services. They can link them up. They can do them all. And they can make the experience seamless. On an iPhone, that experience can't be seamless because Apple isn't controlling them in that way. That's not the Apple paradigm. On a Google phone, I imagine it's far more seamless than it is on the iPhone right now. In fact, Google Now doesn't need to be an app because it's built into the thing. You know what I mean? So we're kind of in this space where it'll be interesting to see how these services grow on the iOS side versus the Google side, in the case of Google, and how, you know, in the case of Facebook, if they're going to pursue their own hardware, if they're going to continue to pursue their own hardware after this whole Facebook One situation, because they do have a growing group of services on what has become a virtual platform. You know, are they going to get hardware that allows them to control that experience? Because right now, I think we all agree that it's yucky to have to go back and forth to different things.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm actually just curious how many people would actually buy like a Facebook phone, because I don't know.
There should be data on how many people bought the original Facebook phone, unless they're hiding that because it didn't do so well or for whatever other reason. Yeah. So we should be able to take a look at that. I mean, the fact is the Facebook phone came out and it kind of was, for lack of a better term, just another Android phone. So I don't know how it was able to distinguish itself as a Facebook-centric device. But it came out around a year and a half ago, so there should still be people using it if they, you know, are stuck to a contract.
Yeah. So, you know, I think I've made a decision. I'm going to start my own suite of apps, breakfast apps. So there's going to be a toaster app, and what's going to happen is you set a timer, and when it's ready, it's going to open up the toast app. And then from there, you can choose the condiment, which will be, you know, a jam app where you get a knife and jam, and you can swap back and forth to
nice.
My breakfast suite.
I just don't know what to say to that.
A Nutella app should be mandatory if you're going to have a toast
app. You can just have like an app party. Toast jam.
Toast jam.
Toast jam.
Toast jam.
Yeah. That'll be your yearly confab to discuss all of the different apps. The Toast Jam.
You should build these into your R2. And when you press the Toast app, R2 just shoots toast up out of his head.
Exactly. Like the lightsaber in Jedi.
There's no reason why R2 can't make you some eggs and some toast. Yeah. I mean, make it useful.
Toast just pops up out of the head.
There's space in there, yeah.
All right, moving on here. After 3 full days of deliberation, a jury in San Jose, California, found that Samsung had infringed upon 2 Apple patents and that it owed Apple $119 million in damages. But it also found that Apple had infringed on one of Samsung's 2 patents and owed $158,000 as a result in the long, long-running Samsung versus Apple case. The jury said Samsung primarily infringed on 2 of Apple's 5 patents. And on the flip side, they said that 3 models of the iPhone and 2 models of the iPod Touch infringed on a Samsung patent. Both numbers are minuscule when compared to the original amounts sought by both companies. Apple originally wanted $2.19 billion in damages, and Samsung's countersuit was for $6.2 million. $119 million or $158,000, that's chump change.
Well, since there's an order of magnitude between what Samsung is owed and what Apple's owed, there's still a monetary winner here.
Sure. Like
there's a bragging rights piece. But
there's a monetary winner.
This is not going to bankrupt anybody.
Apple is clearly the monetary winner.
Job on both sides. That's for sure.
Yeah. No, Apple is clearly the monetary winner, but I'm going to argue that Samsung is the overall winner, because if it only cost them $119 million for the quantum leap in innovation that they capitalized on, that Samsung capitalized on in creating their line of phones, it was totally worth it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I think that there's a PR battle that's still going to ensue. In the end, I don't know that Apple and the iPhone have been able to take this fight that they've gotten to the people in any meaningful way. So, yeah, you know, Samsung has hurt Apple and the court has said, boom, go for it. I mean, there may be an appeal here. Samsung may appeal and say, I don't owe Apple anything. Apple may appeal and be like, no, they owe us more. But I feel like if Apple had worked a little harder to get the users to say this company is stealing ideas, and the stealing of ideas is making things bad in some meaningful way for the user, that would have gone a longer way. But I don't think Apple has that tie to the user. You know, they haven't come across as a sympathetic company for the most part. Not that Samsung has, but Samsung has always kind of come across as the underdog and the snarky commercials about the next big thing. And
yeah,
you know, they do well when it comes to getting other people to notice them and to say, hey, I can be behind that. So you may very well be right when it comes to the PR world. Then there's the fact that, yes, Samsung, if this is the case and this is over and this is how it finishes, Samsung essentially spent $120 million on R&D.
Yep.
That, you know, that just kind of like showed up there. And they can have the ability to say, well, you know, it was a mixed bag. Apple took some stuff from us. We took some stuff from Apple.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, we're all sitting on top, and I make more phones than they do. I sell more phones than those guys do, whatever. We'll just have to see. But it's definitely something that if you're Apple, you're not too happy about this, especially if you were trying to avenge the ire.
Yeah, yeah. If you're going for
Steve
punitive
Jobs,
damages.
Right. And now this isn't over. This is one of a few cases that Apple and Samsung have been a piece of. There's cases going on in Korea. Apple is, again, going after Google itself on Android alone. When you look at the overall devices that Apple was chasing down, the Samsung Galaxy S2, which was designed very much to look like an iPhone 4, you can see why this is so damning. But then you have to look at, objectively, how many of those units were sold, how much money was brought into Samsung from these units, and that kind of thing. And then you might be able to see that, you know, across the line, the run of the Galaxy S2, this is a pretty big win. But in the overall scope of what Samsung's capable of doing, it's not. I don't think $120 million is just a sneeze to Samsung.
No.
But it's something that they can definitely recover
it's
from.
It's worth it. Believe me for them.
$158K, I think you said it was lunch.
Yeah.
For Apple, $158K, that's lunch every day. So,
yeah.
You know.
For what Samsung is getting out of it, it was totally worth it.
And, I mean, the thing is, if Apple had made people actually care, like the consumer, because how can you think of anyone who really cares about this going on that's an everyday consumer? Not really. Like, this is just like, oh, another one of these.
Apple acolytes really care about this because they look at a Samsung device and they get upset that the device is capitalized on Apple's technology and hardware.
But
hardcore,
they're not going to.
My mother doesn't care. My girlfriend doesn't
exactly.
really care.
Yeah.
The only time that people will begin to care is if the long-term effect that this has on the iPhone and other iOS devices is similar to the long-term effect that, you know, Windows 95 had on Apple hardware back in the 90s. That is to say, if suddenly Apple's price premium for the R&D that it puts in and everything begins to make it so that the devices come across as wholly unaffordable and people begin moving to Samsung wholesale, so that Android becomes the Windows and iOS becomes Mac OS X of the 90s, then that's going to be the price paid for Samsung having leapfrogged in technology capability by taking stuff from Apple. It's a long-term thing, and that's something that no one can see until it actually happens. And then they've got to prove that that's happened, and then we'll see. But yeah, it's I feel like as a user, users aren't looking at it from that perspective. They'll only complain when it's gone.
Well, let's talk about that, and that goes into our final story of the evening. Fred Wilson of New York's Union Square Ventures, one of the top tech investors around, spoke at this week's TechCrunch Disrupt conference in New York City, and he says that he believes that by 2020, the biggest tech company in the world, Apple, will cease to be the most important. It won't even be in the top three. He predicted the top three tech companies instead will be Google, Facebook, and, quote, one that we've never heard of. He makes his prediction about Apple because he believes Apple is too rooted to hardware with not enough tied to the cloud, and it'll make it too much of a challenge for it to evolve going forward. He said, I think hardware is increasingly becoming a commodity. Their stuff in the cloud is largely not good. I don't think they think about data in the cloud. Twitter, meanwhile, he thinks will be 4, 5, 6, 7. I'm not sure it'll be number 2 or 3. Now, those thoughts run counter to what Apple stock has been doing in the last 12 months, where it's gone up by 31%. But at the same time, Android has vastly overtaken iOS as the dominant smartphone platform.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the Bible. You can kind of make a lot of arguments based on stock prices and based on distribution of devices.
Yeah.
Right now, it's widely understood that while there are more Android devices on the market, users of iPhone devices spend more money online. It's through iPhone iOS devices that more money is being spent mobily than Android devices. Now, when it comes to the tablet device, there's definitely an interesting shift where people are moving from smartphones and tablets. I mean, people move from netbooks to tablets, no doubt. The netbook is hurt because of the tablet. But over time, between the Kindle Fire, the Kindle Fire HD, and the Nexus 7, Apple's had to pivot to this device, the iPad Mini. And even once that's out there, you know, the phablet has pretty much grown. So people are like merging those two devices back into one. It's still the computer, and it's still this kind of one touchscreen device. So it could be that Apple won't be able to make the margins that it's making on things like the iPad if it's only got one device to sell, like a 6-inch iOS device, a phone. So that could get in the way. Now, at the same time, that ecosystem is a powerful one. People use it more. People like it. People like it in ways because of its stability and all the rest of it. So I don't know that it's so clear, but I don't think that what he's saying is completely wrong. Apple's work in the cloud is poor right now.
Sure.
If you have an iCloud account, you know, 5 gigabytes is free. The next step up really is 20 gigabytes for $40, which is incredibly expensive. The margins there are ridiculous. And it's not data that you can just use for whatever you want to use it for. That's $40 for 20 gigabytes. The next step up is $100 for 50 gigabytes. That's also pretty outrageous. And you can't use it for whatever. It's got to be tied to apps. The apps have to be written in a certain way. The user has no control. And it's built on this idea of simplicity, which is to say, let the app figure it out. You just should go and get your stuff. But in effect, it doesn't always work. So much so that I know just anecdotally, I have 2 iPhone backups on there because one of them got quote unquote corrupted. I don't know how you do that on a phone where you can't even put the sideload software. And I had to put another one on there. It's something that they really have to figure out. They have to figure out this cloud situation. They have to figure out how to make the entire process of using the phone's online systems more seamless. And I know they've done a good job. I mean, I use an Apple TV, I use an iPad, I use an iPhone. The reason why is because there is integration, especially alongside pictures and so on, that is pretty helpful and powerful. But yeah, there's a lot of work to be done in sort of maintaining relevance, especially in light of what I think we can all agree was the failure of Maps and the failure of Siri. When you look at Google Now compared to Siri, you see a technology that is outmatched by what Google's doing. Siri gets these incremental updates every year, where Google Now is growing by leaps and bounds every month. And that's something that I think Apple really has to chase down if they want to be a part of that.
Yep.
And then there's this wearable space where Apple may enter into it, but just like the iPad Mini, that entering into the wearable space is going to be kind of after everybody else has.
Yeah, they're not planning on announcing anything wearable in the next
Worldwide Developer Conference?
Yeah, WWDC.
Right. Well, WWDC has largely become a software space. So with hardware being released or spoken about in the fall during other events. So we'll have to see what happens in around August, September. But the biggest thing here is that even if they do announce a watch or some other thing like that, it's a space that's not been conquered, but certainly inroads have been made by other companies. Inroads have been made by companies that are becoming popular and having their own voice. And the idea that, like, you know, their integrated product would have to be especially compelling. But unlike the previous time unlike previous times where Apple has kind of created this big mythos around itself because it's created a new market, it hasn't created a new market with the iPad Mini, and it hasn't created a new market with what we might see as a giant iPhone, and it hasn't created a new market with anything wearable. It's chasing those markets, and that's where it may be losing ground.
Right. You don't want to be in that position because then you're solely relying on, is my offering better than the competitors?
And right, which is something that they've done in the past. They've been like, yeah, my computer is better than these guys' computers. And they've innovated and they've all done all this stuff. But we're not seeing that level of mythos remaining in the Apple space.
Taking a step back here, I really don't like what they've done in terms of, you know, space, as you can kind of see, is not really much of a commodity nowadays. And they really, really hamper you with what they give as a free user for iCloud. And I'm actually kind of curious if they are making money on it, because the way they really do it is that, you know, first they only give you a limited amount of space, and as soon as you hit that sort of 5 gig cap or get near it, they start like hampering you with messages, like daily messages, because I've clearly hit that cap, and I usually do it because I take a lot of photos and video, a lot of my like R2 progress I use with my phone. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of annoying to see those messages all the time, because, you know, for me, given that I work for a cloud company, I already have a lot of other space in alternative locations. And so I tend to not really want to invest more in Apple's purely sort of isolated space.
And you're talking about this, these pictures and videos. Now I think you begin to understand why EverPix was such a disruptive tech, because you could get rid of it on the phone because all that stuff was automatically thrown up there.
Right, exactly.
And I mean, I know that Box and Box, you know, has the APIs that allow people to pull that data out. I know that Flickr, you know, their app on the iPhone can automatically upload, and I know that Dropbox can do the same. The problem with a lot of those things are that they, in order to pull that off, they need to do things that are, you know, not as integrated as what Apple does. They don't have access to the APIs. They don't have access to all this other stuff. So they've got to use GPS. They've got to use tricks and stuff to get that data up there, and that, you know, ends up in suffering battery life and other things like that. And then users have to find those features and kind of enable them too. So as a user, you're kind of stuck, you know. It's as much as a Box or a Dropbox or a Flickr can advertise, hey, auto-upload your pictures and stuff, it's definitely something that is something that the user has to figure out. Whereas Apple's like, we'll take care of it all for you, but then we're going to say, hey, you're out of space.
You can't really do very much else with it. You can't integrate with many other apps and things of that nature. So that's kind of annoying for me, and I'm definitely not a fan of that. Now, where I was kind of, you know, sort of thinking a little bit more is how they deal with it more. I do like the ability of having, and Google provides this too, right? Having my searches, having all sorts of other content that I've done on one device available somewhere else. So that sort of stuff is positive, but I don't know. They've just not really entrenched them into that sort of space. I wonder what he's trying to describe is, you know, innovator's dilemma, right? That they are not making the changes fast enough, and we'll see what happens.
I mean, they have an option here. If Apple were to take iWork, what they did with iWork, they made iWork free in an effort to draw adoption. If they were to take that iWork model and apply that to iCloud and say, hey, look, the storage isn't costing us. Maybe the bandwidth is costing us, getting all these pictures up there and everything. But let's look it on its head. Let's say that your phone is only going to hold 1,000 images, and everything after that is going to be stored on an iCloud account, and we're not going to charge you for that. That would change the game completely. Instead of what happens now is where we'll hold 1,000 images, and we'll, you know, and your camera roll can get backed up, and you're going to have to pay. They have to move away from this aspect of the fee for service situation. And if they really want to focus on hardware, they have to begin dropping fantastic hardware. Now, we know that in September, when the iPhone 5S was brought out, and we recognized that it had a 64-bit chip and a 64-bit operating system, that there was something – there may very well be something on the horizon that we can't anticipate. The motion chip, another powerful piece. We've seen Nike move its hardware strategy to just, you know, incorporate this motion chip. So – Apple's not done on the hardware side. There's still stuff there. There is innovation between the 64 gigabit chip and the incredible battery life that it has, even with that, and this motion chip. So there's still stuff there, but they've yet to reveal it. And they're going to have to to wow the audience. I also will say that Apple's stock doing well is not, or any tech company stock doing well, is not necessarily an indicator of what the company is going to be able to do in the future. Past stock performance does not indicate future technological success. And a big piece of that is the fact that the stock market often doesn't understand tech companies. You know, you've got stock markets saying, I don't understand. Why is this product this way? And why is that product that way? Why aren't you doing more of this whatever thing? Facebook, for instance. You know, I don't understand why Facebook should have value, shouldn't have value, whatever. Because these products, whether it's a device or a service, they're not standard. They weren't around when the stock market was envisioned the way it is. And if you're Facebook and you decided not to go with ads and nonsense, in the way that some people thought that MySpace looked like in the beginning, people were like, how's it ever going to make money? And now Facebook is making a ton of money. So that's one thing. You know, the Facebook's price, the stock dropped precipitously, but Facebook is now more profitable than it's ever been. So that's just one thing I want to lay out there, that the stock price is an indicator of how a non-technical, you know, tech culture, Wall Street looks at these things and wants to make money off these things, but doesn't necessarily understand these things. And that's a piece of this too.
All right. Well, we've run really long tonight, so we're just going to wrap it up for the evening. And I'm going to start by going around the table and starting with you, Dwayne, asking you, where can we find you on the internet when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can always find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. And you can find me on Google Plus, gplus.to/DwayneD. And we can find me here on the Drill Down.
Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online when you're not here on the show?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. Other ramblings at ircwebcast.blogspot.com. The R2D2 project at toastr2d2.tumblr.com. And also here on the Drill Down.
As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com. That's my social media handle, so you can find all my stuff there. So just look that up in Google, and all of my social links are there. If you have a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture here on The Drill Down, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. You can let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our amazing and loyal audience by writing to sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
May the 4th be with you.
May the 4th be with you.